Welcome to the How Writers Write podcast, a show focused on inspiring and empowering you to become a better writer. Come along as we deconstruct the tips, routines, and motivations of your favorite authors. In the end, it's all about getting your story onto the page.
Welcome to episode 101, How Benjamin Percy Writes. So before we get started, I just want to say thank you for hanging with me over this past month or so of the podcast. So I've been through a real season with my family. My wife and kids and I, we have all struggled with first the flu, which was its own special kind of awful, and then COVID back to back. What a month that was. And unfortunately, we also lost a family member to COVID as well. And you can imagine kind of adding that to the mix. So thank you for hanging with me and for kicking off 2022 with me. I'm excited to be there. For those who reached out and sent such nice letters, some people checked in on me. I mean, thank you so much. I know sometimes it can feel kind of interesting, you know, like here's this audio that you hear from me, and there's not always a two-way communication. But for those people who reached out, it really means the world to me. It really does. It makes this so personal and so, there's just something lovely about that. So thanks. But what I want to say is, okay, here we are, episode 101. That's fun to say, with Benjamin Percy. Benjamin, what an episode to kick off the new year. Benjamin shares so much about his writing life and about how he's created so many amazing stories, from comics to novels to short stories and so much in between. This interview is a blast, and it does all the things. It empowers and it inspires at the same time. There is so much to learn. This is one of those interviews, and in fact, I say it in the episode, where I straight forget what I'm talking about. You know, like I have to kind of reground myself in the episode, because what he said sends my mind spinning so much, I can barely keep my head straight. So this is a good one, and really excited to kick off the year with Benjamin. I want to take a special moment and just say thank you to Benjamin one more time. And now, my friends, without any further ado, here is episode 101 with Benjamin Percy.
Welcome to the How Writers Write podcast. I am your host, Brian, and today's very special guest is Benjamin Percy. Benjamin is the author of 6 novels, the most recent among them being The Unfamiliar Garden, which is book 2 in the Comet Cycle series, and was published, as according to Amazon, today, January 5th. So congratulations. I get to interview you on Pub Day. Pretty cool. Benjamin is also known for writing comics, including his celebrated runs on Nightwing, Green Arrow, Teen Titans, and James Bond. He also currently writes Wolverine, X-Force, and Ghost Rider for Marvel. His fiction and nonfiction has been read on National Public Radio, performed at Symphony Space, and he has been published by Esquire, GQ, Time, Men's Journal, Outside Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and many others. His numerous honors include a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Whiting Writers Award, 2 Pushcart Prizes, the Plimpton Prize, and inclusion in Best American Short Stories and Best American Comics. In fact, his short story, Refresh, Refresh, was included in 100 years of the Best American Short Stories. It's pretty awesome. Benjamin is also regular on the lecture circuit and has taught extensively, including at the Iowa Writers Workshop, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, Tin House Writers Workshop, Aspen Summer Words, and the Paris Writing Workshop, and many more. Benjamin, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
And what an intro that was. I kept reading it and thinking, boy, it goes on and on and on. You have had such a celebrated and amazing career as a writer. Where I want to start out, though, is I want to go before your writing days, I'm guessing. And I want to ask you a very interesting question. Hopefully it's the first time I've been asked this, which is, being a comic book writer, do you remember the very first comic you ever read?
I do. I grew up for the first 6 years of my life anyway, moved around quite a bit. But for the first 6 years, lived in the town of Crow, Oregon. And it was so small that we didn't have a grocery store. We had a mercantile with wide board floors and lacquered fish and deer mounts on the walls. And you could smell the blood off the butcher counter the moment you walked in the shop. And there was a spinner rack in there. And spinner racks used to be everywhere.
Right.
Convenience stores and grocery stores and mercantiles. And I would deposit myself at the spinner rack while my mom would shop. And if I was good, I'd get to bring one home with me. So this was my first comic book shop, essentially.
Cool.
A mercantile, this crusty mercantile. And I read comics over and over and over and over again until they literally fell apart in my hands. So they're all imprinted in my brain, those early comics especially. And that was kind of like the definitive reading experience of my childhood. And the comic that supposedly I read first, it's the oldest one in my collection, and it looks it, is an issue of Man-Thing.
Man-Thing?
Man-Thing, yeah.
Okay.
Which is, you know, the Marvel Comics version of maybe the more popular Swamp Thing.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
So the tagline is, whoever knows fear knows the touch of the Man-Thing. it's this swamp monster guy, Ted Salas used to be his name. And as a result of some experiments gone wrong, you know, he's become... Oh, no, I screwed up the tagline. Whoever knows fear burns at the touch of the Man-Thing. And because of these experiments that went wrong, he, became this sort of hybridized creature that lurks in the swamps and takes down evildoers.
It's so interesting. I've asked that question a couple of times, like the first reading experience that authors have. And it's always interesting how formative those first touches with story can be, you know, because as kids, I mean, I have a 9 and a 7-year-old, and watching them touch story, it's so interesting to see how formative and like just powerful it can be. And as you look back and you think about reading the Man-Thing, can you kind of trace a line of your own story journey back to those types of early experiences, that same type of like feelings that you felt reading the Man-Thing? Like, is there still something that you feel like you've carried forward into your adult storytelling life?
Oh, I mean, there's a direct line. If you look at my latest book, The Unfamiliar Garden, it has literally a symbiote in it. You know, somebody who is both plant and person. And there was something about those early days too, when it came to repetition. I would read comics, as I already mentioned, over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. But I would also check out the same books from the library over and over again. I was obsessed with monster books. So, you know, they sort of presented themselves as nonfiction. But they were all about, you know, cryptozoology, essentially.
Right.
You know, here's the story of the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot and a werewolf that was spotted in the Black Forest, Europe. And here's something about the Hodag in Wisconsin and on and on and on. And I would just get these books over and over and over again. And I also check out this book from the library called The Universal Book of Monsters. And I wasn't allowed to watch these movies yet, but I knew them in and out because of this book, which takes you through all the mummy and the Wolfman and Frankenstein and Dracula pictures with a lot of photo stills included. I mean, I would rent the same movies over and over again, especially Jason and the Argonauts and Sinbad, the ones with the, you know, the sort of stop and go claymation.
Yeah.
So it all of these examples that I'm giving you are the same text in a way. They're all about monsters. Which is a kind of recurring trope in my work.
Yeah. It reminds me, in the morning before I do my writing session, I've started to read a Grimm Brothers story. And they're normally pretty short, right? A lot of them are under 10 pages, 5 pages, just a good way to warm up the brain. And it seems as if the type of mythic touch that a comic has is echoed in those Grimm Brothers stories. And there's something that comics touch really well. I think more than I've ever discussed on the show. And I'm curious about your thought that has like a resonance with like humanity, like with touching monsters. And I'm wondering like have you gone there? Have you like what's your thoughts on that type of mythic overlay with comic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you see in comics a more bombastic, technicolor vision of storytelling, which you could equate with myths of old, with fairy tales. They are, you know, reality with the volume turned up. Mm-hmm. They are storytelling with the volume turned up. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just to touch on a few things, you know, if you're looking at a comic, typically you will find in the hero, in the protagonist, this is a literary podcast.
Go there.
People turn up their noses at heroes and villains, those terms. But you see in the hero a number of wounds. Usually there's one key inside, one core wound. And then through the villains, or antagonists, you find an externalization of these wounds.
Of the same wound or a different wound?
Usually there's one principal villain who embodies the key inside, who embodies the core wound. For instance, Batman, who has the best rogues gallery of any comics character. His principal antagonist is the Joker, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the Joker embodies chaos. Batman embodies law and order. He is an opposite. You know, most villains are opposites or dark mirrors. And this goes beyond comics. But if you look at the key insight, if you look at the core wound that gives rise to that villainous force, it is Crime Alley, something we've seen over and over again in the comics and in the films, whereby little Bruce Wayne, accompanied by his parents, Martha and Thomas, walk through Crime Alley next to the theater, taking a shortcut, and are set upon by never-do-wells who tear the pearls off of Martha Wayne's neck. A gunshot fires. Little Bruce is left in the rain, you know, beside these corpses. And that moment, that fearful, traumatic moment, is what creates the Batman. That singular instance of mindless chaos, right? Mm-hmm. He's trying to control for the rest of the city. Now, there are all sorts of other problems with Batman as well. Like, for example, if you have a story about Dr. Freeze, that story should be about Bruce's emotional coldness. Mm-hmm. If you have a story about Two-Face, it should be a story about whether Batman is the mask and Bruce Wayne the man, or if Bruce Wayne is the mask and Batman is the man. Mm-hmm. If it's a story about Scarecrow, right? Scarecrow has a very similar story when it comes to his origin to Bruce, in that his father conducted fear experiments. He was a psychologist, and he had these fear serums that he was experimenting with, and he would do it, you know, his son was his guinea pig. And so they both have these terrible moments from their childhood. And this relates to Bruce as well, when he fell into the cave and was set upon by, or the well, depending on, you know, what version of the story it is, and the bats, you know, stream all around him. Like, they both have these moments, but, and they are both dark mirrors of one another, as opposed to opposites like the Joker, in that they are utilizing that fear as a weapon as adults. Mm. And the Scarecrow is using it for ill intent, and Bruce is using it to hopefully subdue, you know, evildoers. And if you look at these monsters, right? If you look at these externalizations of problems that exist, cavities that exist inside of the protagonist, you know, the reason that we often go to stories, and I'm speaking beyond comics now, and I'm speaking even beyond, you know, what might be at your local bookstore, and talking even about those times when we were scratching ciphers on the cave walls, or, you know, lounging around the campfire, listening to Ugg, you know, tell us about his day, right? These stories are oftentimes lessons, or they are, you know, they're ways of traversing a gauntlet of the mind, an emotional gauntlet, you know, an imaginative gauntlet that replicates fears and uncertainties that we might encounter this world, so that we can safely emerge out the other side unscathed and experience a kind of catharsis.
Oh,
almost in preparation for what we might face as humans.
Oh my gosh, I need to like pause this podcast and let my brain come back into my head from exploding. Yeah, what you're saying, what you just said so perfectly encapsulated the really choppy question I was asking, which is this idea that both myth and in a way like comics are, how do I say this? It's almost as if they're exploring the dark parts in order to teach a lesson, that there's some output that they're trying to go or trying to give, more than just potentially the value of the entertainment of the story, which is still important. I'm not saying that's not important.
Sure.
But that there's like a nuance in there. There's like a weight in there that both are trying to bring to the experience. And I think you said that so well. Ugh, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do this podcast.
Really primal experience.
Yeah. Sometimes I do this podcast and I hear answers and I'm like, you've really scrambled me and I'm supposed to be doing this interview, but I cannot stop thinking about what you just said. It puts me in a very challenging.
I dropped a nerd bomb.
It's very challenging as an interviewer. I actually want to reverse though, and I want to go back to something you said, which was really interesting. Which was this idea that the hero and the antagonist, the hero and the villain, are sharing some sort of similar struggle with the concept, a similar struggle with a theme, but one is coming at it from one way, the hero, the villain's coming at it from the opposite, and by that device, tension is inherently created.
Yes.
Right? Just inherent in the narrative, tension comes out. And my question for you is, do you find yourself taking that form into novel writing as well? Or is that something that doesn't necessarily translate that well from comic to...
This is evident in my mm-hmm. novels. It's evident in my screenplays, but not just in my own. It's everywhere. Whether right. people are aware of this or not, it's playing itself out on the screen and in the pages of whatever thriller or, you know, literary volume you just picked up. If you look, let's like talk about some other examples beyond comics. Like what about Sherlock Holmes? You know, I said that most villains are either an opposite or a dark mirror. And Sherlock Holmes's greatest, you know, nemesis is Moriarty, who is the exact same character. He is Sherlock Holmes, but he uses that skill set for ill intent. If you look at Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark finds his principal antagonist in Belloc, who is Indiana Jones. Except Indiana Jones is always shaking his fist and going, "That belongs in a museum," and Belloc is more interested in power and money, right? But oftentimes when you have larger canvases for stories, especially as opposed to like a short story, you have both. You have both at work. You have the opposite and you have the dark mirror. There's two different antagonists. I mean, I'll give you an example of this from a comic that I wrote 52 issues of, which is Green Arrow. So Green Arrow is... a character who, you know, you could consider a cousin to Robin Hood. A Robin Hood, you know, the contemporary landscape, and he comes from this really powerful family, the Queens, and, you know, the mythology differs depending on which era of continuity you're looking at, but typically he has this fall from power, and he's disgraced, and he loses his money. And so when I was writing Green Arrow and taking over the series, rebooting it, I was looking at sort of these classic canonical examples and trying to come up with who my villains were going to be. And I wanted there to be, of course, a Prince John character, and this would be the Dark Mirror. This would be the character who went to prep school with Oliver Queen, who was incredibly privileged. And now Oliver Queen, as the Green Arrow, is trying to fight the man. He's trying to fight against capitalistic forces, especially. Like, he, you know, learned something from that privileged life that he's now weaponizing against that same system. Whereas this other guy, this Prince John character, becomes the mayor of Seattle in my run. He is instead more of a Trumpian character, even though they had the exact same upbringing. And it's just trying to soak up, you know, all power, all money that he can. And then I have this other character who, again, if Oliver Queen is like a social justice warrior in the truest sense, I have, I tried to come up with like, okay, what would be a really badass villain? And I said, a bank, how about? And actually a bank sounds really boring at first to the comics editors at DC Comics. They're like, a bank?
A bank?
Can't make a bank.
Chase
a bad guy. But I was like, well, all these bad guys, where do they get the money for their awesome lairs and weapons? You know, they don't just walk into like Wells Fargo and be like, can I get a loan for my laser beam gun? So I came up with this idea of a like a battleship bank that floated in international waters called the Inferno.
Oh, cool.
And it was, you know, run by this guy named Dante. And you know, it looks like it has like this neo-Gothic appearance and everything else. But
yeah.
These are all like, this is what is funding villains worldwide.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I have this opposite like of him. And then I have this dark mirror of him and he's battling both. And, you know, so this is what you oftentimes see in films and TV shows, in novels, is that you have both of these examples set before you. And when it comes to like people being wounded and trying to overcome that key insight, it's everywhere. It's in Sleepless in Seattle. The first shot of that movie is Tom Hanks and his son standing over the grave of his wife.
Right.
You know, if you look at Les Mis, and you have
favorite, you know, book of all time.
He's stolen a loaf of bread and he's been in prison for all these years, you know. And now he's run away and he runs into all of these, you know, different, essentially, you know, he's fighting against different versions of himself, and opposites and dark mirrors, and Javert might be the principal force, but there are all these other antagonists around Javert as well. So anyways, what I'm talking about is, without getting too deep in the weeds, is that this is something that has helped me, yes, that has helped refine my storytelling as a prose writer. Because comics are just such a bombastic example of storytelling that I've been able to look at them and see things in a really obvious way that are sometimes explored more subtly in fiction.
I love that. Yeah. And the way you're describing it, I mean, again, we're over 100 interviews at this point, and the way you're describing it has such a clarity. That I think there's a lot of writers out there who are going to think about their protagonist and very quickly see like, hey, do I have this type of like inherent tension that I'm building within my narrative, so that my protagonist is naturally set up to have some sort of battle or some sort of struggle for the thing that they want most. And I think an asterisk, a really quick asterisk too, something interesting is it's, you know, sometimes I think you even see characters who have, you know, those different antagonists within themselves. You know, it's not even necessarily external to them. They might have one of those that they themselves embody and their principal struggles against themselves, not necessarily against an external force. And that can make for great fiction as well.
Exactly. And you know, you're talking about just like how comics have influenced me as a novelist. And there's so many ways I could go on it.
Cool. You need to write a book on this. This is so good, by the way. I want a whole nonfiction book on this.
Just a few small things, like a comic has, you know, 5 to 7 scenes. A comic has an A plot, a B plot, a C plot, and a D plot. And the B plot of one issue becomes the A plot of the next, and the C plot becomes the the B plot, and there's typically a splash page. In other words, a singular image that takes up a whole page within the first three pages, and a splash page that is the last page. And some of the things that I've learned from this are, you know, that I think that Terence Hayes says it best, the poet, and that he says that, you know, if you look at the difference between free verse poetry and form poetry, like a sonnet or a villanelle, you know, it's cool if you can break dance, but it's badass if you can break dance in a straitjacket. Mm-hmm. And for me, writing comics is breakdancing in a straitjacket because of the constraints.
Right.
It's not 24 pages. It's exactly 20 pages. And it's 5 to 7 scenes, as I said before. And there's these, all these different elements that I have to sort of check off my list. And as a result of that, right, you always know when you're writing a novel that you should be doing a number of different things at once. You know, you should be contributing to character and a theme and a plot, but you know, you've got 300 pages or 700 pages, right, and you can get a little baggy and loose.
Yeah.
But in comics, you don't have a choice. That's why, for instance, if there's a fight scene, nobody will shut up, right? The heroes and the villains are all talking to each other while they fight because you only have 20 pages. So you have to be having an emotional, cathartic moment as they're punching the hell out of each other.
I love that.
I can just look at how my novels have become so much more efficient as a result. Mm-hmm. And also I apply this when I do teach to my students. I say, okay, let's look at this chapter. I want you to panel it for me as if it were a comic. Mm. Okay. So they start to go through and they're like, all right, you know, page one, panel one, characters are sitting at a bar, enjoying a beer. It's like page two, panel five, page four, panel seven, they're still at the bar, still drinking that pitcher, still talking.
Right.
And I'm like, what is the point of this scene? Meaning, what do you want to result from it? It's like, well, he learns that his sister is going to run away with this ex-con or something like that. I'm like, okay, if that is the point of the scene, why are we there this long? That's the beat of the scene. And I think about storytelling in horizontal and vertical vectors. And the vertical vector is the emotional well. And the horizontal vector is movement. And I think that literary writers are often really good at the vertical. They're really good about the emotional well, not so good at the horizontal when it comes to, you know, narrative progression. So if you panel the story, you see explicitly how there is no horizontal progression.
Right.
And so I want you to be, if you're one of my students, somewhere in between. Mm. I want you, you know, if you think about the horizontal and the vertical vector, I want you to be at more of a diagonal.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good way to think about it and to illustrate it. I'm learning so much from you in this podcast. I'm sure I'm going to get a zillion notes about all these thoughts. In our remaining time, I want to do a quick transition and talk about your current novels, the current series you have. The Comet Cycle. And I read this wonderful Marlon James blurb about it where he said it's like part sci-fi, part dystopian. I mean, he just has such a way of expressing things. The language was so fun. And I'm curious if this idea of like dystopian, sci-fi, speculative fiction, when you look back at the past couple of years, past 2 years of the pandemic, plus of the pandemic, do you think that those... the season of the pandemic has influenced your current work, has influenced the Comet Cycle? Do you feel as if you're borrowing new emotions that maybe the pandemic has produced that have kind of found their way into the work? Or do you think that it's been something that's kind of this dystopian future has always been something that's on your mind, that has always been something you've wanted to express?
Well, oftentimes speculative stories will channel societal unease.
Right.
You see this over and over again.
Right.
Godzilla, which is about post-atomic anxieties, or Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is about the Red Scare and McCarthyism. Or look at every single George Romero Living Dead feature. And he reinvents the metaphor depending on which era in which it's being produced. You know, like Living Dead, strong connection to the civil rights movement, especially in those last few moments. of the film. You look at Dawn of the Dead, and you've got the rise of Reaganism and consumerism as it takes place in a mall with zombies stumbling about and filling their pockets with change from the fountain. And staring at the mannequins, you know, within recognition. Day of the Dead's all about Cold War anxieties and blah, 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 blah. So when I wrote The Unfamiliar Garden, the pandemic had begun. And, you know, I guess my response is twofold. I think it's always important to channel something personal and raw onto the page if you want your audience to feel as well. And so part of that is the pandemic, and that the story is about contagion. It's about a fungus. You know, the comet cycle in general, just to contextualize it really quickly, you know, it's an age-old sci-fi concept in that a comet comes streaking through the solar system, the planet spins through the debris field, it introduces new elements via this meteor shower that upend the laws of physics and biology and geology and shake up the geopolitical theater and shake up the weapons sector and the energy sector, and in a really marvelly kind of way creates a new dawn of heroes and villains. So with that in mind, the second book, you know, it takes place in the Pacific Northwest, which is the wettest corner of this country, and it has to do with alien plant life. So if you look at what I'm doing, it's similar to what Emily Dickinson says, which is to tell it slant, right? You don't write it something directly, you write around it. And in this case, I'm writing around the pandemic, and then it's, you know, this thriller, the sci-fi thriller, mm-hmm. a lot of mystery components, some elements of horror, but it's about an invisible enemy riding the air. Mm. And it's about people eyeballing themselves, you know, their neighbors, their colleagues, even their family members with suspicion, because they might already be inhabited by these fungal spores, which, you know, once they take possession, unify sort of an intelligence and makes this book kind of a contemporary Invasion of the Body Snatcher scenario. So yes, there is absolutely that connection. And I think you see that connection in so many different horror and fantasy and sci-fi stories, but there's also a personal element to it as well. And this is what I was talking about before, like if you feel something, then your audience will as well. Mm-hmm. And people are always asking me, because I write horror now and then. I don't consider this book a horror novel, but I have written horror in the past. And they're always asking me, what am I scared of? And my response is usually kind of jokey. You know, oh, I'm afraid of clowns or darks or dentists. That last thing is actually true.
That last one.
but here's what I'm actually afraid of, honestly afraid of, and that is something happening to my kids.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that really terrifies me.
Yeah, right.
And we had, you know, my kids are 12 and 15 now, but when they were younger, we had some really scary episodes. Their air passages were undeveloped when they were infants, toddlers, and every winter it'd be this horror show of croup. And they couldn't breathe. And, you know, we'd be in and out of ERs and the ICU. And, you know, worst memory of my life was watching my son with his face turning blue, put onto a gurney and put into the back of an ambulance in the middle of a blizzard in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I had to follow that ambulance sliding through these snowy streets, not knowing what was going on inside.
Oh my goodness.
And so this book is very much, it's about the, you know, cheeseball comic booky stuff that I was just telling you about before. It's a sci-fi thriller and blah, 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 blah. But it's really a family story.
Yeah.
And it's about these two parents who are, you know, facing an impossible situation when it comes to their kid.
Yeah. 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 It's interesting. It's like you're combining. I got to move my microphone closer to my mouth. I'm not used to having to hold a mic. So if I sound weird today, that's why I'm holding it. But you're combining these, you're combining, it's interesting, like this, a bunch of what we touched on, you know, this idea of borrowing this kind of a monster-ish reality and pulling that into our world and having that be a metaphor for something, borrowing these fears that you feel and finding a way to get those onto the page, the last question, kind of before moving to the final questions, is how in these stories, maybe you don't want to say this, right? Because you don't want to give away too much, but in these stories, did you pull in and say, like, who is the dark mirror to my protagonist here? Did you consciously think about that? Or did you just go through and write it and see what showed up on the page? And then it kind of edited your way to through it.
Yeah. You know, it's tricky when you're mapping out stories, when you're writing them, do you want to do that left brain imposition over mm-hmm. what is principally a right brain activity? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, when it comes mm-hmm. to like, okay, on this page, I need to have an inciting incident, or on this right. page, I need to have a gateway into the second act, or who is my dark mirror, and so on. And I know that kind of stuff can seem unnatural, but this is the way I've trained myself to create, in that I have, and you can see one version of this over my left shoulder, since we're zooming, there's a scroll on the wall.
Okay.
Now, just to my left here, I have a closet in my office. And this closet was used as a dark room by the former owner of this house. He was a hobby photographer, and that was his dark room. And I used that dark room as my nightmare factory, I guess you could say. That's where I have articles that are clustered together, trimmed out of newspapers and magazines. They're tacked up. Like, there's one cluster on the wall right now when it comes to stolen art for a project I'm thinking about. And then I have like set pieces, action set pieces that I could potentially plug into stories, or fears. I have a sheet that just says scares, fears. And then I have these scrolls, these big scrolls. And what I do with these scrolls, and the reason one's over my shoulder, is because the dark room is full right now. So that my office is now spilling over to my office. I have a design, a blueprint. And oftentimes I think about and mess with these scrolls for a year to 2 years before I ever actually write.
Oh, it's so cool.
Tap the keyboard, right?
Yeah.
The writing, you know, sometimes the writing is not actually typing. So this is a writing activity, in that I visit these scrolls almost every day. And I can't keep a whole book in my head. I think it's important for me to visually embody it, so I can look at it and I can move the pieces around. It's all in pencil because I'm constantly erasing. And what I generally do is I have a banner statement at the top, and it could be like alien fungus story, or it could be post-apocalyptic reimagining of the Lewis and Clark saga. That's my novel, The Deadlands. Or, you know, Red Moon, which is, you know, create a scientific analog to the werewolf myth. And so on. I have my banner statement about what it's about. And then on the left side, I have my characters. And I start to draw up not just cartoons of them, but kind of Wikipedia entries on them. Once I figure out who they are, I figure out what they want. Once I figure out what they want, I can put obstacles in the way of that desire. And that's when, on the scroll, I go from these clusters of characters on the left side to these threads, these plot threads. And I'm not figuring out everything, but I'm figuring out these principal moments.
Yeah. Yeah.
And part of this is figuring out, okay, I have like, okay, who's the dark mirror? Who's the opposite? Mm-hmm. Who's the sidekick? Who's the window character? Who's the love interest? Who's the teacher? You know, when it's coming to like archetypal characters.
Yeah. Yeah. A little hero's journey in there. Yeah.
So I have this approach. I don't know that I need this approach anymore, but I wrote 4 failed novels before publishing one. And I think most novelists say the same thing.
Yeah. I think I'm going to speak for just about everybody on the show that I would give my right leg to hear you talk about that for as long as it would take for you to detail that process. Like, just take the leg off at the hip. Yeah. I keep the recording and I can watch it whenever I want. It sounds fascinating the way, it's almost like this combo. It's what's cool about what you're saying that I've not heard before. It's almost just a kind of organic symbiotic process between the left and right brain, where you're thinking, but also feeling, and have that like Alan Watts, don't force it type energy, where it just kind of develops and blooms the way it needs to without sitting down and forcing something to happen before it's ready. And I'm enamored with it. It's such a cool
Well, it helps concept. Me be fast too, as a writer, because I don't know everything that's going to happen. That would be boring.
Right.
But I know the skeleton.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Okay. Benjamin, I literally could listen to you talking about storytelling all day, but I'm looking at the time and I regretfully have to pull us into our final question. So I ask these exact same questions to every single guest. I just added a sixth one. So I guess I can't say every guest, but I ask the same questions every guest because I firstly really like the answers. They make me happy and it's my show. And so that's what, one of the reasons I do it. And the second reason is because so much of what I'm trying to do here is illustrate there is not one correct way to write. There is no form you have to follow. And my hope is that as you hear, as listeners, as you hear all of the diversity of answers that come out of this from beautiful, wonderful writers across every genre, level of experience, debut authors, and people have sold hundreds of millions of books, right? Like everywhere in between there, that you realize everyone does this their own way. And I hope you as a listener and writer find your way to write. That's almost entirely the whole reason I'm here. So with my preamble said, let's dive into it. So this is the new question. Question number one. As a storyteller, what do you view your role is in the world?
Well, when I first found myself obsessed with comics, novels, and movies, and TV shows, it was principally about escapism. You know, I lived in the middle of nowhere, and this was my rabbit hole. Mm. I think that that is, in a way, true for many people. It grew more complicated for me, though, in that I was also, I came to realize educating myself through these books. And I mean that geographically, I mean that historically, I mean that culturally and politically and empathetically. I was trying to live through others and find a better way of being. You know, I began to actually read in middle school, especially, sort of for instruction on how to be, I know this sounds a bit corny, but a man.
I love it. Yeah.
And then things got complicated further when I started studying writing and became more obsessive about craft. And that, you know, it wasn't just about entertainment and it wasn't just about education, that it was about, you know, the integrity of a thing. Hmm. And then there's that next level that I got to as well. And this is when I actually wrote that story, Refresh, that it's probably going to be the thing that outlasts me. That seems to be the story that everybody loves best. It's my Don't Stop Believing if I was Journey. But that story was meant to incite action and even, you know, in an editorial way almost, to be, you know, a work that was political and even polemical in a sidelong kind of way. So, you know, I'm touching on a few things there. And sort of they get more and more complex as I go along, but it's to entertain. It's to thrill, but it's also to educate, but it's also to, you know, create something that's artfully told. And it's also maybe to move some minds and hearts.
Mm. Okay. Let's go to the next question. What is the one word that best describes you?
I will say that whether people like my storytelling or not, the one thing that no one can take away from me, that everybody recognizes, is that I work really hard. Mm. And so that bullheadedness, that drive is sort of definitive for me. And that I've heard no 1,000 times and I've failed 1,000 times, but I keep going. And I think that is more important when it comes to my career than talent is.
Yeah. I've heard that so much in these interviews, this idea that you almost have to have like a cessation of belief. And just to keep going, you know, you're going to get so many no's that if you start believing the no's, it'll stop you in your tracks. You almost have to be able to stop the belief of what you're hearing like fool yourself in a way, have a stronger way. One of the things we teach kind of in some of our courses, having a stronger belief that overcomes those kind of, you know, 2x4s of the face, you know, because they're coming, you know, they're coming. Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Never stop coming.
Yeah. Right. Question number three. If you had to pick a spirit book, so this is a book, like if you died and you were able to be reincarnated as a book, this would be the book that you would choose. What book would it be?
Oh man, that's a great question. This might not be the right book if I thought about it long enough, but it feels like the perfect book, given how enchanting I found it and given its subject matter. And that is The First 15 Lives of Harry August by Claire North, which is all about a character who is reborn again and again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And every time they're reborn, it's in the exact same time period and the exact same circumstances. His mother dying in the train station as she, you know, gives birth to him. But he accumulates all the knowledge of his previous lives.
Oh, wow. That's cool. I've never read it.
He cycles through again and again and again. And it was brilliantly told. It was also one of those books that just made me pause. Like The Overstory did this as well. It kind of changed my way of thinking about the world. So any book that can have that kind of magic, not just to sweep you away, but to like change your hard wiring.
Yeah.
Overstory
is so good. Yeah. Okay. Question number four. Is there a specific tool? Can be anything at all. Pencil, software, chair, coffee, tea, anything at all that you absolutely must have to write.
No. I've written in any and every circumstance. I've written on planes and hotel rooms, on trains and diners, quietly at my desk, loudly at a kitchen table. Like, I've done it on paper. I've done it on laptops, done it on desktops. And I drink a lot of coffee. That's the only thing I can say that I need to keep my brain powered up. But I actually have, even though I think that habit and routine are the best possible things you can do for yourself as a writer, when it comes to productivity, just the nature of life is that you're rarely offered that perfect little platform for your muse. So I've trained myself to write through anything and with anything.
Yep. Love it.
But a cup of Joe is always good.
You know what? I think coffee is the most consistent answer I get to that question. I think if writers say anything, it's almost always coffee or really good headphones. Like those are like the two things that writers give me a lot. Okay. Question number five, how do you deal with the constant ups and downs of the writing life?
Yeah, it's a struggle. And it's a struggle that continues. You mentioned the 2x4s to the face, and I'm sad they keep coming, and they do. But, you know, early on, when I was sending off short stories in grad school, I had this thing called the wall of shame. And I know that all those journals said like no simultaneous submissions, but I was just looking at the math of the situation and it didn't work out.
Yeah.
I was like, right, I'm waiting 6 months to hear back from this journal. Right. It could be years before I get a yes. So I just carpet bombed. I made a list in Excel. This is before there were things like Submittable and whatever else people use these days. I don't write a lot of short stories anymore, but I had like this system where I was like, okay, this is my top tier. This is my second tier. This is my third tier. And for every, I'll send off 10 copies to the first tier. For every rejection I get, I'll send off 10 more copies to the second tier. For every rejection I get from the second tier, I'll send off 10 more copies to the third tier. And it worked, you know, but along with the acceptances, I got just bombarded with rejections. And I had this thing called the wall of shame, and I would tack up the best rejections to it. And by the best rejections, I mean like they wrote a form letter, but at the bottom, some intern or maybe even the editor like wrote a nice thing.
Yeah.
Or gave me some advice. And so I would stand in front of that wall of shame with my coffee smoking in my hand every morning. And it would be almost, you know, it'd be like somewhere between my mindset was somewhere between like, you got to do better and screw you. And I think that that was just the perfect sort of training ground for my mindset these days. You know, I just came to recognize immediately that there was a larger game going on beyond even the quality of the manuscript when it came to acceptance, and that acceptance wasn't the only thing to worry over, mm-hmm. whether made a story grand or not. It wasn't the reason that I was at the keyboard, but it was part of this larger matrix that I was trying to work to become a full-time writer. And so there was kind of like a business-like gamemanship to it. Yeah. And there was also just like this artistic pursuit. And I really enjoyed the interplay of the two. But anyways, I still get rejected almost every day.
Oh my
it could
God.
Be like me pitching Hollywood. Mm-hmm. It could be me, you know, pitching Marvel Comics on an idea that I want to do for an event. But what I've come to recognize is that all of my successes have come out of failures. Mm. And that the wreckage, whenever you face wreckage, there's always a turn up ahead. Mm. You know, and I could go on for this about that particular thing for an hour.
You can take my left leg
for that time. But there you go in a nutshell.
I know. I'm like, when can I schedule a second podcast interview with you? Because I'd love to hear that story as well. My gosh. Okay. Last question for you. If you could give one piece of advice to new writers, what would it be?
To slow down and reread and reread and reread. I was talking about repetition earlier when it came to my own reading habits as a kid and viewing habits as a kid. But for whatever reason, I forgot about that when I went to grad school. I was in a rush to read everything because I felt like I was so far behind. And as a result, I started to lose track of characters and books. They were all converging in my brain because I was just banging out this short story, this novel that I thought I had to have in the library of my head. What changed is that I was like, okay, I was having some trouble with plot at the time. And I was like, I'm going to focus on somebody who's really good with structure. You know, I looked at Flannery O'Connor, mm-hmm. for instance.
Right.
And what I would do is I would reread one of her short stories like 6 or 7 times. And then I became emotionally detached from it. Mm. And I was I could recognize all of its component parts. Mm. And then I would create a blueprint that matched her story, paragraph by paragraph, beat by beat. For instance, paragraph 1. Character A introduced via dialogue as jealous and spiteful, which is their principal weakness. Mm. Paragraph 2, theme introduced via description of setting. Right. So I take these specific things and then generalize them. Okay. And then I would use that same skeleton to try to write a story of my own. So I'd be like, okay, my first paragraph, I'm going to introduce the character's principal weakness that will be overcome in the story. Mm. And I'm going to indicate that through something that they say and do. In the second paragraph, I'm going to maybe describe mountains or something. You know, this is a story about revenge. I'll describe the bloodlit mountains and the fang line of the granite peaks or whatever. Anyways, I did that like 3 or 4 times and it just clicked. I was like, I get it. Mm-hmm. And then I started assigning that to my students later on. I would make them read a story repeatedly, then blueprint it, then write a story based on that blueprint, and then present to the entire class a speech that explicated all of their stylistic choices based upon that origin source. And everybody pointed to that being the greatest exercise.
Yeah.
Most helpful exercise that they had ever undergone.
Yeah. I would imagine you produce some good writers from that exercise. Can imagine there's
slowing down. Yeah. Look into the hood, find the component parts. I rewatch movies 3 to 5 times. Some director's commentary on. Read the screenplay and, you know, rewatch the scene, trying to figure out how it's working so well.
Yeah. And I think some writers look at that and they think it's like, we have these discussions sometimes internally and it's like some writers look at that and they think that's cheating somehow, like as if that's like copying in a way. And, I, whenever I hear
well, in that exercise, it is explicitly copying.
Yeah.
And that's just an exercise that's supposed to help you understand
right
how to put together your own skeletons.
Right. Yeah. And it's, I always like to see too, it's like, it's kind of like reading sheet music to learn music in general. You know, writers, we don't always have the sheet music. And by studying other writers, you know, you get the sheet music a little bit. You kind of get a little bit more of the blueprint, and it just helps you understand how this thing can be done, some ways it can be done. And it doesn't have to be that way. It's just a way it can be done. I think it's such an awesome exercise. I mean, like, I'm sure there's a gazillion writers out there listening to podcasts. We're going to immediately do this tomorrow. So thank you for sharing it. Really quick, Benjamin, where can people find you online? Where do you hang out? What's the best place to dive?
I'm on all those obnoxious social media platforms. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook.
Okay.
I have a website as well. So.
Okay. Okay. I think I am kind of overwhelmed with all of this. Like, this has been such a great, it's kind of exactly what we try to do in this podcast, and the amount of just depth of knowledge you shared. It's such a privilege for me and honor to be able to talk to somebody who understands stories so fundamentally and so deeply, but can also communicate it so articulately. And so I deeply appreciate your time, Benjamin. I appreciate you freely sharing so much with myself and all the listeners. And
it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What a ride. And so for those of you who write speculative fiction, read speculative fiction like myself, again, today is Pub Day for Benjamin's second book in the Comet Cycle series, The Unfamiliar Garden. So go to your independent bookstore if you have one. If not, go wherever you can find it and grab that series and check it out. Benjamin, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Happy New Year. And it's been such a pleasure for me.
Hey, thank you. And good luck, everybody out there, with your own writing.
Thank you.